You are listening to Talking Machines. I'm Catherine Gorman.
And I'm Ryan Adams.
And today, Ryan, you're going to introduce us to perturb and map. What is that?
So variously, we've talked about the idea of structured prediction. So this is supervised learning, where instead of just having a single label like cat versus dog or a regression label like temperature or something like that, you have a collection of things. And the collection of things together has some kind of interesting structure to it that you want to predict. So a good example, and maybe the classic example of this, is something like image segmentation, where if you think about separating the foreground of an image from the background of an image, then you can view that as producing a little binary label for every single pixel in the image. Is this part of the foreground or is this part of the background? That is, if there's a cow in a field, is this part of the cow or is this part of the field? And so that's a little binary label, again, for every single pixel. And they have an interesting and complicated relationship. Maybe we would expect that if one pixel is part of the foreground, then the pixel immediately next to it is also more likely to be part of the foreground. Plus interesting sort of effects, like we would expect maybe pixels along the edge of the image to typically be background and so on. The point is that there's interesting structure that we expect to have on this label space. It's not a simple 1-0 label, it's this big collection of things. And this happens in a lot of other regimes as well. Ranking, maybe search results, and things like parsing natural language and other sort of areas where you really need to sort of label a bunch of related data all at once. So this is a hard problem, and the most common approach to it is to use something called a conditional random field. So when we talk about a random field, what we're talking about is a collection of random variables that are all coupled together in some interesting way. And a Markov random field is a very common way to model different kinds of relationships, where basically we can talk about simple relationships essentially between each of, say, the pixels in an image, and then altogether that forms one big distribution over this collection. When we want to use these in a supervised way, though, we want to condition on some other kind of input. Like, for example, we might want to condition on the colors of the pixels that are nearby some pixel you want to label. So if we want to decide whether this particular pixel is cow or field, foreground versus background, then we might want to look at an interesting little patch of the actual image around that to decide whether or not it's foreground or background. And in the case of something like ranking search results, then we'll necessarily want to look at the properties of the documents that we're considering, as well as the query that, say, the user punched into the computer. So this is a very nice formalism for thinking about inducing distributions over complicated things. Typically, the way it'll work is we'll have some energy function, just like we would have in a Markov random field, and e to the negative energy is then a Gibbs distribution over the possible configurations. That is to say that what we're doing is coming up with a log probability over all of these big configurations, and if we sort of exponentiate that to make it positive and then normalize, it gives us a distribution. When we make that a conditional random field, then what we're going to do is make that energy a function of, say, the properties of the image or the properties of the query or whatever additional information that we have available. And so then we're changing the energy function according to that, and therefore changing the log probability and the, you know, whatever the actual distribution is. And so that's cool. It lets us handle cows differently than it handled ducks, and deal with sort of foreground versus background depending on kind of what the actual image looks like. And this is also a natural thing to couple with things like deep learning, where instead of just saying that we're going to condition in sort of like with a linear regression, we can now have a big deep convolutional neural network or various other kinds of things. So this is a very important idea in machine learning, and it's you know, it's been around for a while now, but it's essentially about handling big complicated objects and distributions over them. There's something really challenging about conditional random fields, though, which is that most of the time for complicated random fields, normalization is very hard. That is to say that we get this energy function, we go e to the negative energy, we get this now positive function, but to interpret it as a probability distribution, we need to be able to sum over all the possible configurations. And if we think about summing over all the possible configurations of, say, something like the binary pixels in an image, then we're talking about a lot of possible configurations, 2 to the number of pixels, right? And that sum may be totally intractable, and we call that the partition function. And it's necessary in order to do learning most of the time in these kinds of models, because there's this tension between fitting the data well and ensuring that you're assigning low probability to the data that you haven't seen. And that sort of tying down of areas that you haven't seen for which you have no data, and so therefore you think they're unlikely, you need to be able to make sure that you can account for that. So you can't just look at the data, you also have to look at the regions that don't have data or the thing or it won't work. So the partition function is really important to being able to compute these kinds of things. But that sum is challenging. So there's been a variety of approximations. People have done a lot of different kinds of work to sort of tackle this. So in this case, perturb and map, but map stands for maximum a posteriori. So that just means perturb and then find the maximum of the energy. So this is a way to construct a generative model over things like, say, binary image segmentations or other kinds of structured objects. But rather than treating them as a conditional random field where we condition on the data and then get this unwieldy Markov random field with a partition function that we don't know, instead what we're going to do is take our sort of conditional random field, and we're going to randomize the weights in it a little bit, and then we're going to find the most likely configuration under that new energy function. So we're going to find the ground state configuration. So that's why we say perturb and map. So you throw some noise into the weights and then you maximize. The reason that's an interesting thing to do is because it gives us a distribution over possible configurations, but we can sample from it without having to actually look at what the partition function is. We don't actually need that partition function in order to generate data from the model. And the reason is because there's this kind of interesting discrepancy in a lot of sort of structured combinatorial objects in which counting is very, very hard, but finding the maximum configuration might be something that we can do efficiently. And here I mean efficiently and hard in the sense that of like computational complexity. So a good example of this is thinking about something like matching. So your sort of configuration space is things like permutation matrices. And so finding the partition function then is essentially computing a quantity called the permanent, which is like the determinant, but super hard. And it's actually sharp P, that is to say super hard. And however, there is an efficient algorithm for finding the most likely matching in such a configuration. And this is called often the Hungarian algorithm, and it runs in something like cubic time. So it's polynomial. So it's very efficient to find the best configuration, but very hard to compute a weighted sum over all configurations. And this comes up in a lot of different situations, like shortest paths, and it comes up in image Markov random fields where finding the partition function is hard, but using like a max flow min cut type algorithm may give us a very efficient way to find the most likely configuration. So this happens quite a lot, where counting is super hard, but maximizing is easy. A couple of years ago, Papandreou and Yule proposed this idea of saying, well, let's just throw out the basic idea of computing this partition function, and let's instead take advantage of the fact that maximization is easy. And somewhat in parallel, although they sort of wrote this very nice paper earlier than we did, Danny Tarlow and Rich Zimmel and I wrote a paper also talking about this idea where we call them randomized optimum models, where the idea is you randomize a problem whose optimum you then compute. But what was really wonderful about the original perturb and map paper is that in addition to sort of proposing this idea of modulating the weights and then finding the most likely configuration, they also sort of introduced to the machine learning community this idea of this kind of Gumbel max trick that I think we've talked about a little bit before, and observed that if you select the perturbations correctly, then you actually get the original model back. That is to say that you have this giant discrete distribution, and we know from the sort of Gumbel max trick that if you modulate that distribution, if you modulate the parameters of that distribution and then maximize, then you get the same distribution as you would have if you just sort of like exponentiated and normalized. And that's just a really, really beautiful result to show that actually these things are very tightly coupled. And then it's led to sort of like an interesting class of other ways to think about inference in these kinds of models. And it's kind of spawned a little industry. There's a book coming out, with sort of several different contributed chapters. I think if it's not out yet, it will be in the next couple of months, It's always nice when we're tackling difficult machine learning problems to remind ourselves of which parts we want to work hard to preserve sort of exactness in and which parts we'd like to be willing to approximate. And this is a different take on that for conditional random fields. And so I think it's a really sort of fun area to track.
We'll have more on Perturb and Map and the paper by Papandreou and Yule on our website, thetalkingmachines.com. This week's listener question on Talking Machines is about the difference between artificial intelligence and machine learning.
My name is Bob Ducharme, and I'm an author and tech writer at CCRI, a research firm in Charlottesville, Virginia. Your podcast has always done a great job of distinguishing between the concept of machine learning and the concept of AI. The popular press lately, not such a good job. My question for you is this. Of all of the classic tools and techniques of AI from before the current large-scale applications of machine learning, do you see any of those tools and techniques still playing much role in current research? For example, the use of symbolic logic using programming languages like Lisp or Prolog or their derivatives. Thanks.
Thanks for the question. So it's interesting that you would talk about how we distinguish between machine learning and artificial intelligence, because I actually don't think we do really distinguish all that much between these. And that's because to me, intelligence has to do with adapting to your surroundings, and that it's very difficult to talk about something being intelligent without talking about learning. And so I really don't see I don't see a bright line between them actually at all. In response to the meat of your question, I think it's a very interesting thing to ask whether some of the older techniques in AI have really, kind of what influence they have on current research in AI and machine learning. And I think one important thing to keep in mind is there's a sense in which computer science as a field is actually all about AI. Now, whether you're talking about building systems or whether you're talking about proving theorems or whatever it is that we're doing, ultimately, computer science is about the analysis of algorithms for automation. That is, how do we make computers do things that we want them to do for us? And that is, in a sense, indistinguishable from AI. That's not to say that all of these areas are the same as the subfield of AI, and it's not to diminish them in any way, but it's simply to observe that computer science is about automating these devices, and I think that is really what sort of we're trying to do when we solve AI. It's like, how do we build computers, and how do we build reliable systems that do things on our behalf? So I think it's difficult to overstate the impact that thinking about the AI problem has had on lots of things that are incredibly important to, say, an undergraduate computer science curriculum, but that we maybe have at some point stopped calling AI. A really good example of this are things like search. Basically, any situation where you're coming up with an efficient data structure to search over some large set, a lot of these techniques grew out of AI. Same thing with planning and other kinds of algorithms that we've kind of stopped thinking as being a core part of AI, but really, I think, kind of grew out of that kind of thinking. And these are still incredibly important. And in fact, I think if we were going to look and say, what's the most amazing accomplishment, most amazing recent accomplishment in AI over the last several years, a lot of us would probably say that the AlphaGo victory is the thing, right? That this is the key moment in the last couple of years where you said, okay, wow, people are really making progress on AI. Well, neural networks were a big part of that, to be sure, but Monte Carlo tree search was also a big part of it, maybe the bigger part of it, where the clever combination of convolutional neural networks with what in some ways is a more traditional approach to playing games that has not a lot to do with, with sort of modern deep learning. I think it's that looks like ideas from good old-fashioned AI actually contributing very heavily to a modern success. So I guess I don't think these things are going anywhere. You mentioned Lisp as another example, and one of the very exciting areas of machine learning right now is probabilistic programming, and one of the sort of And in the last couple of years, that's gained a lot of interest. And part of the reason it's gained a lot of interest, at least to some extent, is because of the work of like Josh Tenenbaum's group. So this is like Noah Goodwin and Vikash Mansinga and Dan Roy and other folks who developed the church programming language and the and church is Scheme. It's just a dialect of Scheme, and Scheme is a stripped down dialect of Lisp. One thing you have to keep in mind is that when we're talking about a methodological field, and make no mistake, machine learning is a methodological field. We're building algorithms, we're building ways to solve problems. That the importance of a particular idea is not necessarily well captured by whether or not it is hot in the methodological research area right now. That is to say that linear regression is a really important, incredibly important, maybe the most important idea in supervised learning. And people don't do a lot of research on linear regression these days. But the fact that if I go to NIPS or ICML or I pick up, you know, JMLR or something like that, that I don't see a lot of papers on linear regression does not mean that linear regression has become a bad idea. It just means that it doesn't reflect the cutting edge of methodological research. And I think the same is true for a lot of these important ideas from, you know, from years ago in sort of artificial intelligence research. They're still good ideas. They're just not they just don't represent the juiciest frontier of research in this area right now.
If you've got a question for Talking Machines, email us at thetalkingmachines@gmail.com or tweet us at TLKNGMCHNS. This week's guest on Talking Machines is Jake Abernathy of the University of Michigan. And we got to talk to him at ICML this year in New York. And I asked Jake the first question that we ask everyone when we sat down. How did you get where you are?
Oof, complicated. Do you want me to start with elementary school or
kindergarten?
It all factors in, I guess. I have an interesting story that I'm actually a high school dropout. Professional juggler, and then turned math nerd, and was a math geek, and then decided to get into computer science because a GSI and my teaching assistant in my undergrad told me I should, and then thought that I should get into bioinformatics because that sounded interesting. There weren't enough mathematical abstractions in bioinformatics at the time. I found out about this thing called machine learning from an internship I did in France when I was about 22 or 23, and then I guess got a little bit addicted to that, and by the time I was 25, I got into UC Berkeley for a PhD program, and you know, then things escalated from there, I guess. That I ended up, after that, did a postdoc at the University of Pennsylvania, that was 2011-2013, and then started a faculty job in 2013 at the University of Michigan, and this is where I am today.
So tell me about what your group is doing now at U of M.
Well, there's a bunch of things going on at U of M. I have still a pretty small group, and it's been fluctuating recently. I can talk about two different kinds of things that I've been doing recently. One thing that's been taking up a lot of my time over the last 3 months is this project with Flint and the Flint water troubles. This is unusually applied project that I got engaged in, and it's been actually a lot of fun. I mean, most of my research is on the theoretical side. Published papers mostly with LaTeX and mathematical expressions with theorems and proofs and things like that, and haven't done a lot of applied work, at least in the publishing front, but I guess I got a little bit interested in data science-y stuff, particularly when I started analyzing course grades and homeworks scores for students. Now, teaching classes in machine learning and in computer science more broadly is a big data problem because the number of students that are enrolling in computer science degrees now is exploding. It's been, I know in Michigan, it's been increasing something like 12% per year, the number of enrollments. So I started playing around with those data sets and then organized this data science team. We call it the Michigan Data Science Team. It was actually part of my NSF career proposal. I said I was going to organize this group, thinking I would put together a sort of a group that would work on competitive machine learning challenges. You know, work on things like Kaggle problems and maybe also local problems and get people excited. And we give up prizes when students get the best predictions. In the same way that Kaggle works, we were going to have internal prizes for challenges. And one of the first data sets that we worked with that I was particularly excited by was I scraped a whole bunch of data from ratemyprofessor.com, and we decided to do a bunch of sentiment analysis on the actual text of those ratings to figure out what are the how can you determine the quality of a professor just based on the things that are said about him or her online? So the Michigan data science team became just a little side project. We had about maybe a dozen, maybe 20 students coming regularly to these meetings. And, you know, we're giving out $500, $600 in prizes early on. That was in the beginning of this year. This all started about a year ago in September of 2015. What happened was in around, I think it was February of 2016, a few months ago, we got contacted by folks at University of Michigan Flint, and they said they needed folks who were experts on who could work with and try to reason about and, you know, deal with data sets on the Flint water crisis, because at the time there wasn't a lot of work being done. And what happened was Google had given money to UM Flint, University of Michigan Flint. There's a campus, satellite campus in Flint, Michigan, to develop something that would be useful for citizens and folks living in Flint to understand the kind of the details and the nitty gritty of the water crisis issues. And I'll get into the details of that in a moment. But what they decided was they needed someone who's, you know, on kind of the machine learning side of things, on the sort of data side of things. And they contacted folks in the University of Michigan Ann Arbor, which is where I am, and said, do you have anyone or a group that can, you know, would like to engage in this? And so they asked me, and I said, sure. And this sounds like fun. I mean, this sounds interesting. I thought it was going to be maybe a small little mini side project. But instead, it's basically occupied my life for the last 3 months. It's been probably the majority of my time has been spent dealing with this. And what became clear is that was cool about this, and what became clear when I started taking drives up to, okay, so just the background of the Flint water crisis, what happened was it was discovered by academics and also folks in the, you know, in governmental agencies that there were problems with Flint's water. And what had happened was they had switched the water source from the Huron River to the Flint River. They just changed the water source from one to another, and in the process didn't do the necessary things that you need to do to keep to not corrode the pipes and the things that keep lead pipes mostly safe to have water flowing through them. And when they did the water switch, and no one really noticed, but all of a sudden later people started testing their water, and high levels of lead were being discovered in the water, and significantly higher than I think people would have thought. And it looks like maybe the government was trying to fudge the numbers to show that it wasn't the case. But in any case, they switched the water source back. Things are improving. But in the meantime, the entire city stopped drinking their water. And, of course, national news media attention was drawn to the issue. And, of course, the Democratic presidential, there was a debate that was held in Flint, and of course they were talking about it at that point. And it was, you know, there was a Republican governor, so it was sort of a way to score political points in the Democratic Party. But amidst all that, because of the fact that people were concerned about their drinking water, they all started to get their water tested. In fact, the state of Michigan decided to make it free to test your water. And because they wanted to be as transparent as possible, they were publishing those tests on a regular basis. And all of a sudden, we had a huge data set of 20,000 lead samples that were measured in various places around the city. And, of course, they even gave us the addresses of those locations.
Wow.
And in the process of going to Flint to, you know, just to ask about what data sets were available, and I started talking to city officials, and it became clear the city of Flint does not have anyone that's really able to do any data science or anything that really takes advantage of the information they have. Now, they have collect data, they have records of things, but they don't seem to be using any real scale to, you know, make good decisions for the city. So we just started looking at the data we could get our hands on. We got data on every home in Flint, all, you know, the age of the property, how large it is. There are some records on the service lines used for the property, so what's the material of the service line. Those are very noisy records. We have samples of water being tested. We know, for example, what the nearest fire hydrant is. It might seem strange, but the type of the fire hydrant on a block happens to be relevant to understand the actual materials under the ground. We were able to scrape a bunch of data to figure out people's water usage, because it turns out that your water bill is actually publicly available online. I should, by the way, say a lot of this stuff was done by students in this data science group. So after several weeks of work with a lot of these students, we had several data sets, and we noticed there were several very obvious prediction problems. Only a fraction of homes were actually testing, like maybe a quarter or a third. So you might want to ask, well, what homes are actually at risk? What homes should actually be testing their water and be concerned? And we were able to provide predictions for that. And so we have sent spreadsheets to different organizations to say, here's where we think you guys should be focusing your efforts. More recently, and we were able to, of course, you know, use standard methods to sort of, you know, figure out what are the key features of a property that would determine possibility of risk. And you might think, oh, well, if it's in a risky neighborhood, it turns out that's actually not as true as you might think, that the high lead readings don't seem to be localized in any real way. You don't notice that there's, it's this neighborhood or that neighborhood. So the other things that we've been working on recently, and it's been very exciting. There's been an appropriation by the state of Michigan to replace a lot of these service lines because there's an expectation that the problem is the service line is the pipe that connects the house to the water main. There's always a big pipe running down the street that's on the public property, and then of course there's a line that runs between the house and the water main. That's called the service line, and in fact the service line has two pieces. The problem is that to find out what the actual material is of the service line, you have to send a hydrovac over. The hydrovac has to actually dig into the ground and actually inspect the type of material. So we have a really interesting problem here where before you spend $1,000 digging into the ground to determine the material type, you'd actually like to have a decent estimate of the likelihood of finding an actual lead pipe, because if you dig into the ground and you don't find a lead pipe, it would be somewhat embarrassing for the government if they spend all their money in the wrong places. So we've been actually having meetings with the person in charge of actually deciding where to make decisions about where to actually inspect for lead, and that's been exciting. And I mean, I think this particular individual, it's General McDaniel, he seems to be interested in big data, and he seems to have respect for what we're doing. And it's clear that like the state of Michigan is not it's not really equipped to do this kind of stuff. There's no real data science people who work for the city of Flint who are able to help out with this stuff. So it's been exciting for us to be able to insert ourselves. Maybe I'll add one more point to this, and one thing that's been clear from the work we're doing, which is that the media attention to the service lines is somewhat of a concern to us, and we feel like it may be problematic. We've been somewhat reticent to actually make this public, but I guess I'm talking on this podcast now, and I'm sure this is listened to by at least tens of thousands of people. The service lines are probably not the problem, and we know that because we have some record of the service line types, and we find actually only weak correlations between the levels of lead that come out of people's taps and the type of service line material. What's likely to be the actual major culprit are things like lead solder used in the homes, possible lead pipes used within the homes. There's been concern with different types of water heaters, apparently fixtures in the home, maybe the actual faucet type might be the actual cause of lead, and if you unscrew an aerator, oftentimes little particles of lead that were in the pipes originally have now been caught in the aerator, the faucet aerator. Unfortunately, there's less data on these things. The service lines, there's actually records, at least to some extent. There's very weak, weakly maintained records. But we've been trying to get to these things because, it's an interesting public health issue, and suddenly people are, money is going to be flowing in the direction of helping this particular city and maybe all other cities as well. And we noticed there really hasn't been any real, big data-like efforts, machine learning-driven efforts to try to understand these problems. And for this particular instance, for Flint, we happen to have amazingly impressive data sets just because, of all the attention that's been paid to the problem. I will mention that the original goal of this, which is something that's still being worked on, is actually an app that's being developed by students and faculty at UM Flint, and they're actually building a little app. And this whole project is funded by Google. Google gave about $150 million for this project, and that app is going to be used for folks in Flint to be able to look up their address and get an estimate. What's the likelihood you have a lead service line? Have you tested your water? No. Here's what we think you're going to read. If you get it tested, you probably should get it tested, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and to provide some information about that. So the end goal, or at least one of the goals that we've been working on, is actually just providing value to citizens, folks who live in Flint. But, the stuff we're also doing is to try to help out with, governments and decisions that governments are making. That's a very brief overview of the work that we're doing on this particular project.
So in your time in this, have you found anybody else who's working on municipal big data?
I should give some credit. There are folks that work in, this is usually referred to as GIS. GIS is, I guess, I always get this wrong, Geographical Information Services. There's certain departments and organizations that refer to GIS as basically when you're doing things like city data, like if it's crime data, or where roads are, where pipes are, where signs are, they're often storing that stuff, and people are working on that stuff. And you do see that there is research on, for example, automatically detecting the location of street signs and other things using vision algorithms. So there has been work on this stuff, but there's been less work on understanding water contaminants, and that's probably because the data sets have tended to not be very large. Civil engineers, they go home to home to get samples of water. So the idea that we had basically, roughly 10,000 or more people volunteer their time to submit a sample was kind of amazing, and was, made it, useful and interesting for folks like machine learning researchers to get involved in the problem. So yeah, this is a very sort of specialized issue, using actual data science obviously, people who, I should give credit to civil engineers. We've been talking to civil engineers and water quality experts. They do lots of stuff, but they tend to not be, they don't come from statistical backgrounds. They're not trying to use complex algorithmic tools to actually make estimation. They tend to be trying to reason about, engineering questions, what types of materials should you be using? How do you avoid corrosion? How can you test for things like Legionella? Those are the kinds of questions, those folks are primarily interested in.
And generally, you work on questions of statistics and economics, right? This is a sort of a sidetrack for you.
Yeah, this is a bit of a sidetrack, although, one of the things that I emphasize a lot when I give talks and I try to remind people about is that people tend to think of machine learning and economics as completely separate fields, and there's, very little relation. And I find that to be surprising, because I find that, for me, machine learning is entirely about economics, that we're trying to figure out how to allocate resources efficiently. And algorithms are ways to do that. Markets are ways to do that, and algorithms are ways to do that as well. In this particular case of Flint, if you think about it, we're not... Whether our predictions are good or not is not really that interesting. What we need to do is tell this particular, government officials where they should dig. Now, that's an economics question. We are trying to tell them where they should be concerned about finding lead pipes. And if they want to save money, if they want to, make the process more efficient, they should do it using tools that we have. And I think that's something that I, have tried to emphasize in when I talk to people about, the research that I do.
So you mentioned that your data is showing that the lead pipes might not actually be the problem. It may be the older housing stock in Flint is actually the problem. So when you're up against an issue like that, where the assumption is not borne out by the data, how do you broach those questions?
It turns out that little fact, a lot of the policymakers, the in-depth policymakers, they seem to be aware that this may not solve the problem. Mm. The problem with this issue is that service lines replacing pipes that connect from a government piece of property, a water main to the house, you can make an argument for that to a citizen. Saying that we're going to enter your home and start to do testing and maybe replace some of your plumbing, that's a lot harder for governments. And particularly in Flint, the population in Flint does not trust either the city government or the state government. Well, they especially don't trust the state government. They may trust the city government a little bit more.
Given the history of the takeover in that particular city, they would have a lot of reason not to.
There's a lot of there are a lot of issues in Flint, but yeah, I think that's a town where the population feels like they haven't really been supported in the way that they should have. Even the University of Michigan, didn't get a lot of credit for helping for getting involved in this crisis. It was actually researchers from Virginia Tech that really broke the story, and it was a doctor from MSU that observed that blood lead levels were elevated in Flint soon after this the crisis was happened. She working alongside Mark Edwards from Virginia Tech, they really broke the story on this.
So if you were to give someone who's thinking about their thesis or what sort of project they want to embark on next advice about municipal data or working with it, what would you say to them?
If you're going to be purely a data scientist, I would say try to find areas where we have where we can somehow obtain data sets on the scale of what we've been able to do. Getting, for example, information about every parcel of land was surprisingly easy, and we have poked people to send us certain spreadsheets, and they've been more willing to do that than we thought they should have been, because, for example, we now know how many dogs are in every address in Flint, which
I didn't know they kept that information.
Apparently, they do. So, the thing about and what I've been observing a lot is when you're trying to do stuff with data, one of the problems is that everyone has spreadsheets on machines inside of municipal buildings or in government, government offices. The question is, what incentive do they have to provide it to you? Cracking that nut has been an interesting one. I think this is something that anyone who kind of deals with real-world situations, who deals with real-world data, and tries to solve, problems. And a lot of more empirical researchers, I think, deal with this a lot. Having someone actually send you the spreadsheet that contains all the information that they have, it's often hard. You're pestering them. They don't see a lot of benefit for it. But the records that are being kept have so much value. I mean, in some sense, there's privacy issues all over the place here. The fact that we get to see everyone's water usage in the city of Flint by scraping a website is crazy. I mean, how do we have access to that information? Well, for some arbitrary reasons, that information was made available online because I guess it's a public utility. But you could imagine that, for other scenarios, that would be, inappropriate, and there would be lawsuits, and they wouldn't allow them. So I think what I'd be interested in for other municipal problems is figuring out how you can, how can one get access to data sets that probably we shouldn't have access to. And I think there's probably a broader question of I would say something I'm interested in is a broader question of how do we get organizations to realize that there is potential and unseen value to making information that they're collecting available to the world, because you put out a spreadsheet on something and all of a sudden you can have a bunch of undergrads and grad students, actually it's mostly grad students, working on this stuff and coming trying to figure out problems and predictions. I'll just give you another example. The project we worked on kind of alongside, and we started right before the Flint stuff, was working with the University Musical Society. The University Musical Society puts out dozens of concerts every year for the population around Michigan. And they really do have some of the best shows in all of Michigan. I mean, they get some of the top acts to come to Ann Arbor. And, of course, every visit to their website is collected. Every time someone purchases a ticket, it's collected. It's recorded. They release this data to us. I mean, basically everything you could imagine they released to us. And they said, can you help us? We need to figure out how to recommend, shows to people. Mm-hmm. And we were like, sure, we can do that. That's the stuff that we do, actually. And a lot of these students, really engage very heavily on this stuff. And essentially these organizations got, I would say tens of thousands of dollars of free consulting resources without paying a dime. We did it for fun. I mean, these students basically did, working on that because they had free time and they want something in their resume and this looks cool. So, trying to encourage other organizations to, we had personal relationships with the folks in the University Musical Society. We were able to bring this about, but other organizations may not see the value in making their data available to researchers or to, academic organizations.
Jake Abernathy of the University of Michigan, which I should disclose is my alma mater.
It's interesting. We've had we had Ian Murray on two episodes mm-hmm. ago, and he is also a very serious juggler. So mm-hmm. I don't know. So it's been a juggler kind of month.
Maybe if you juggle and you're in machine learning, tweet at us. Maybe we need to do a study about this.
According to Ian, there's a huge overlap.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. All right. Juggling correlations. Our first Talking Machines paper. That's it for us this week. I'm Catherine Gorman.
And I'm Ryan Adams.
Tune in next episode.